From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for the first Sunday in April, April 3rd, 2016. This is our weekly recap of the political scene for the week that was, and we'll try to give you a heads up for what's up in the days ahead. So grab that Sunday paper, that hot cup of coffee, and we'll try to get this week off to a good start. Well, I got to tell you, Dave, yesterday, so much for turning the corner on the weather.
I mean, it was more like January 2nd than April 2nd.
Those wind gusts nearly knocked me on my behind yesterday afternoon in running through these buildings in downtown Chicago. And I would tell you, that's not a good look at any time, but it definitely wouldn't have been a good look because then the snow would have started to cover me on the sidewalk.
Exactly. I couldn't believe some of those snow squalls. In fact, it was almost like a whiteout. I looked up at Sears Tower a couple of times out and around in the downtown area yesterday. And, it was just unbelievable.
Well, in fact,
60 today.
Yeah. National Weather Service reports of yesterday with wind gusts of over 50 miles an hour at O'Hare. And they did say that, you know, when you got further south, Pontiac may have gotten like around 60 mile per hour gust, but definitely true whiteout conditions in some of those clear areas, you know.
Yes, right. Pontiac, correct. Also in Indianapolis, the Indianapolis area had some down power lines, upwards of 9 to 10,000 people without power overnight in the Indianapolis area. And as we mentioned in the news, we have a wind advisory going into effect at 11 this morning until 7 tonight. Wind gusts could be up to 45 miles an hour again today, but warmer wind rather than the snow.
Yes, no snow. I just saw Mike Kamernick's report, right. And he promised no snow today.
We'll hold him to it.
But, I mean, it's so bizarre. So the temperature right now, I guess, officially is
30 degrees.
We're at 30 degrees.
We're at 30, okay. Yeah.
And it was 30 degrees at 5 o'clock this morning.
Right, yes.
And I'm thinking in 12 hours, we're supposed to double.
Yeah, and we will double a high of 60, probably a little further away from the lake, which is typical, of course, for this time of year. But then tomorrow, back into the 30s. Temperatures falling tomorrow afternoon. Partly sunny, but don't put away those heavier sweaters and coats.
And a chance of flurries, too, tomorrow.
Yes, yeah.
So, wow.
Winter never leaves Chicago without a fight.
No, it doesn't.
Never.
And you never put away your winter coat.
No. Not when we've seen snow in May around here.
And frankly, and I'm thinking here we're coming into the opening week of baseball season.
Baseball getting underway this week, that's right.
And I remember...
Cold weather like this, typical for opening day.
Exactly, exactly. I was telling a friend yesterday, I remember going to an opening day Cubs versus Pirates where there were snow squalls.
Sure.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
For opening day. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, there's nothing better than sitting at Wrigley and watching it snow on opening day.
I've been there when it's been cold and rainy and miserable, but I've never seen snow inside Wrigley.
Well, and it's always that wait till next year kind of thing, and then you're sitting there and it's snowing and it's going like, okay, I'm not sure this is going to be. Yeah, this is not a good way to start the season here. But then I know the Sox home opener I think is Friday, and they're talking. Again, chance of flurries for that out at Cellular Field. So.
You know, you just sparked a memory. You really did. I think it was opening day at Wrigley Field 1982 was snowed out.
Snowed out.
They had
completely.
They had to cancel the game. Oh. The very first game of the regular season was snowed out. A huge lake effect snow storm just came in, and all of a sudden, there was like 6 to 8 inches out of nowhere.
And I won't even ask you where the Cubs finished in 82. I sure don't remember.
Yeah, 82.
We know they didn't get to the World
they
Series.
They did not. It wasn't until 84 where they finally broke that long streak of not even getting to the playoffs since World War II.
Yes.
But I believe it was opening day of 1982 was snowed out.
Wow.
82, 83, one of those years.
But you know, still, it's baseball. Another sign that things are turning
Absolutely.
The corner. You've got the Masters tournament is coming up next weekend. And there's something, you know, yeah, golf on TV is not the most exciting thing in the world. But the way they craft those shots down at Augusta National is, it just.
Absolutely.
That to me, you know. That's a real turning point that, you know, even though they probably cheat a little bit and spray paint green on the greens a little bit.
And put in artificial flowers somewhere.
I think they do. They're real flowers, but they may just bring them in for the weekend.
Okay. A good floral shop.
Exactly. Yes. You've got a good business in Augusta, Georgia during Masters Week, I think, if you've got the floral shop.
Well, actually, it would be warm enough where they actually would have some flowers there in bloom. But then again, you know, it can be unpredictable there. Look at the weather patterns that have happened in the southern part of the country here.
Right. And, you know, and as you mentioned with the yesterday's winds plus Indianapolis, too, you know, taking a hit. That's, I want to tell you, Dave, it's good to be back.
Welcome back, by the way. Amanda was, as usual, a very, very good host last week. Had some good guests on and some good conversation, but best wishes to Amanda. I hope she can come back. You know what? You guys should set up a co-host thing sometime.
We've talked about that.
Yeah.
We actually have. And I did have her one week she just as a guest, and she stayed for the entire show. And Amanda Vinicky of WUIS-FM and Illinois Public Radio in Springfield.
Yes, it's
WUIS-FM in Springfield. Thank you so much for doing an outstanding job. She's first rate. And yes, Dave, she will be back. Trust me.
Good. All right.
I also want to say thank you to Father John Cusick and everyone at the First Friday Club of Chicago for inviting me to speak to them last week. It was a very attentive audience and a lot of great questions. And we could have probably done, another hour afterwards. But I truly encourage anyone who didn't get their questions asked to join the conversation this morning at 312-981-7200. The event was a lot of fun. A lot of people said they listened to the show and wanted me to extend a warm welcome to Dave as well.
And that's very nice. Thank you very much. Hello to you.
Yes, and thanks everybody for inviting me to that. And one of the things I talked about was kind of the lack of civility in society anymore, and how that kind of is really evident in these the way people respond to political candidates or political writing and things like that. And
how about the way people respond to reporters' stories online in various newspaper articles?
Yes, and that was one thing I mentioned. But also, I wrote this short story, President Obama's coming to the University of Chicago on Thursday, make his pitch for Merrick Garland as the replacement for the late Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. And at the bottom of the story, I noted that, and it was largely to let everybody know he was not going to be spending the night in Chicago, that he was heading off to the Los Angeles area for a Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee event. And I got an email. This is a short story. It was 8 paragraphs. I got an email from someone who accused me of deliberately not using the word fundraising event.
Oh, really?
And I'm going, you know, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, that's the only kind of event they have. I didn't know that it necessarily needed to be stated that it was a fundraiser. And this gentleman informed me about how I obviously did not use the word fundraiser, and that fortunately for him, he was so discerning that he knew that it would be a fundraising event. But for the uninitiated out there, you know, I was engaging in an act of deception.
Were you civil in your response?
Yes, I always am civil.
Yes, you are.
But I did suggest to this person that the next time that there's a sale on Reynolds Wrap, they might want to stock up, because I have to tell you, I mean, if that's how deep the conspiracy is, then maybe it's time for me to hang it up. I don't know. But, and it was nice that he was, you know, smart enough. And I said, okay, so you know everything, and you assume that people that read these stories are not as smart or as well-educated as you are. And I said, that must be a great feeling to wake up to every day. But I was civil. I didn't.
You were.
Yes, I was civil. But I'm actually thinking, and as I said, I talked about this at the First Friday Club of Chicago, and I'm actually thinking maybe of devoting an entire show to that kind of subject about, you know, where civility has gone. And we're certainly, as I said, we're certainly seeing it in the response to political candidates.
And in the campaign itself.
Yes, exactly.
In the campaign itself, you will have no shortage of texters and callers for that subject.
No, not at all. Not at all. Well, we're going to explore that possibility later as the campaign season develops. But Dave's here to keep us up on the news, and also he'll be filling us in as the Shamrock Shuffle takes place.
Starts in an hour and 10 minutes.
I can't wait. actually, we've seen some of the people getting ready for the race out here outside the Allstate Showcase studio, jogging along Michigan Avenue. So good luck to all the runners in that. Producer Jasmine is fielding your phone calls. And as I said, you can reach us at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that same number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter @SundaySpin, and engineer Bob is shoveling the remains of yesterday's snow off the buttons that make the station run. As always, if you have to tune away, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com, and you can also get our podcasts at iTunes just by searching Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take our weekly spin through national politics. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Just a heads up on our lineup today. After Dave's 7:30 news update, Republican State Representative David McSweeney of Barrington Hills. After Dave's 8 o'clock newscast, incoming Democratic Representative Teresa Ma joins the show. She'll be the first Asian American to serve in the Illinois General Assembly after November's general election. And then after the 8:30 news update from Dave, my Tribune colleague Juan Perez Jr. joins the show, and we'll talk about Friday's day of action by the Chicago Teachers Union and what lies ahead for the union in the Chicago public schools. That's all coming up, but first it's time for our weekly spin through national politics, the focus on Wisconsin, which holds its primary elections just north of our border on Tuesday. Texas Senator Ted Cruz appears to be the favorite there now, particularly after Donald Trump stepped in it when questioned by MSNBC's Hardball host Chris Matthews on the issue of abortion.
Should the woman be punished for having an abortion?
This is not something you can dodge. If you say abortion is a crime or abortion is murder, you have to deal with it under the law. Should abortion be punished?
Well, people in certain parts of the Republican Party and conservative Republicans would say, yes, they should be punished.
How about you?
I would say that it's a very serious problem, and it's a problem that we have to decide on. It's very hard.
But you're forbidding it.
Are you going to say, well, wait, are you going to say put them in jail?
Is that what I'm asking you about? Because you say you want to ban it. What's that mean?
I am pro-life, yes.
What is ban? How do you ban abortion? How do you actually do it?
Well, you know, you'll go back to a position like they had, where people will perhaps go to illegal places.
Yeah.
But you have to ban it.
You ban it, they go to somebody who flunked out of medical school.
Are you Catholic?
Yes, I think.
How do you feel about the Catholic Church's position?
I accept the teaching authority of my church on moral issues.
But do you know their position on abortion?
Yes, I do.
And do you concur with that position?
I concur with their moral position, but legally, I get to the question. Here's my problem with it.
No, but let me ask you, but what do you say about...
It's not funny.
Your church? Yeah, it's really not a funny thing. What do you say about your church? They're very, very strong.
They're allowed to, but the churches make their moral judgments, but you running for president of the United States will be chief executive of the United States. Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah, there has to be some form.
Ten years?
I don't know.
You take positions on everything else.
I do take positions on everything else. It's a very complicated position.
So now, several hours later, in a statement, Trump said that women who obtain abortions are victims, and if Congress passes laws outlawing abortion, it's doctors who provide them should be punished. But Trump's critics say it's just another example of Trump making things up as he goes along. For example, here's Trump speaking to a reporter from Green Bay, Wisconsin's Fox affiliate on his derogatory comments toward women.
Well, number one, I'm no different than anybody else, and people joke, and I joke, and I never knew I was going to be running for office, and you joke, and you kid, and you say things, but you're not a politician, so you never think that anybody cares. All of a sudden, you decide, because the country's doing so badly, that you're going to run for office, and then they take every single thing that you've ever said over a lifetime. Much of that I said in jest. Much of that I said, although with the Fox debate, I didn't say that in jest at all. I mean, I said that 100%. Because Megyn Kelly never treated me fairly, and everybody knows it.
So it's in jest, but then maybe it's not in jest. And, it's gotten to the point where Trump has become very politically toxic to many people. He's perhaps the most disliked candidate to perhaps win a major party nomination in decades of polling. And Democrats are doing their best to link Donald Trump and Republican candidates up and down the ballot. Here in Illinois, that's what Tammy Duckworth has been doing in challenging first-term Republican U.S. Senator Mark Kirk.
Would you support Donald Trump if he is the nominee?
If he was the nominee, I certainly would.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
Do you know that John McCain was a birther?
He's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay?
Would you support Donald Trump if he is the nominee?
If he was the nominee, I certainly would.
Trump calling the protesters thugs on Twitter is doing little to cool things off.
But now the poor guy, you got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
You could see there was blood coming out of her eyes. Blood coming out of her wherever.
Because he doesn't have a birth certificate. Maybe it says he's a Muslim.
Would you support Donald Trump if he is the nominee?
If he was the nominee, I certainly would.
That's a web ad from Democratic Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth's campaign in challenging Republican U.S. Senator Mark Kirk. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. And 30 degrees outside right now, with a high scheduled to get above 60. So, yes, welcome to Chicago in April. Just to continue a little bit with our spin through the national politics, and I kind of touched on this issue of civility. Well, Obama, the president, appeared at the Toner Awards, which is awards for news reporting, last week. And noting Trump's rise, Obama said that he recognizes the need to report, but also kind of criticizes the media's need to profit in their news coverage. This is the president.
Ultimately, I recognize that the news industry is an industry. It's a business. And there's no escaping the pressures of the industry and all its attendant constraints. But I also know that journalism at its best is indispensable. Not in some abstract sense of nobility, but in the very concrete sense that real people depend on you to uncover the truth. Real people depend on getting information they can trust because they are giving over decision-making that has profound effect on their lives to a bunch of people who are pretty remote, and very rarely will they ever have the chance to ask that person a direct question or to be able to sort through the intricacies of the policies that will determine their wages or their ability to retire or their ability to send their kid to college or the possibility that their child will be sent to war. These are folks who trust you when you tell them that there's a problem in their schools or that their water's been poisoned or that their political candidates are promoting plans that don't add up. That's why the deep reporting, the informed questioning, the in-depth stories, the kind of journalism that we honor today matters more than ever. And by the way, lasts longer than some slapdash tweet that slips off our screens in the blink of an eye. That may get more hits today, but won't stand up to the test of time. And that's the only way that our democracy can work.
That's the president. Now, one point I'd like to add here is that while he hails the work of journalists, under the Obama administration, the U.S. government has set a new record of withholding freedom of information requests, according to a recent AP investigation. Those Freedom of Information Act requests are basically an indispensable tool of reporters in trying to learn how our government works. So, like everything, take what the politicians say with a grain of salt. Back in the Republican presidential campaign, Texas Senator Ted Cruz was using a voicemail video to run not only against Donald Trump, but against the media, the liberal media, as he calls it, and the Washington establishment, or as he calls it, the Washington cartel.
From day one, the Washington cartel and the liberal media have conducted an all-out assault on our conservative values in order to try to derail this campaign. They've tried everything they can to stop us and to force me from the race. But thanks to you, we're still standing. And it's because of you that we are on the verge of winning the Republican nomination. As the only conservative remaining out of the once crowded field of 17 candidates, I'm recording this special message to personally ask for your help.
And for your money. That's the way the game works these days. That's Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Well, joining me now on the phone is State Representative David McSweeney, Republican from Barrington Hills. And Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I know you wanted to get up early just in anticipation of that Blackhawks game.
Well, it'll be a great game this morning. Go Hawks. We need a win going into the playoffs.
We need several wins going into the playoffs and a lot of help on defense, I think. Things have been looking a little shaky. Not a good way to roll into the playoffs.
Well, we're a playoffs team, so I'm optimistic.
Well, the legislature is back in session next week and coming off a, quote, spring break. Coming off what the governor criticized Democrats for of scheduling vacation. But I'm really wondering, after we've seen the results in the Illinois primary, has anything really changed, any dynamics really changed as the legislature comes back into session?
Yeah, Rick, things have gotten a lot worse. You had a great article in your paper today about how students are thinking twice about going to Illinois schools. Chicago State is on the verge of potentially shutting down. Eastern Illinois University, Western Illinois University are in a lot of trouble. Community colleges like Harper College are laying off people. There was an outrageous story earlier this week that we paid $900 million in late interest fees in the state of Illinois. Imagine how many kids could be educated for $900 million. So things have gotten a lot worse. We're in full crisis mode, and I know that sounds like Groundhog Day every time I'm on this show, but it's gotten worse. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And we're back tomorrow, and there's still the political games going back and forth. We need a budget in this state. I mean, we're in a full crisis. The people of the state are demanding a budget. And on the other side of this, people are talking about a major tax increase, which is unacceptable.
Well, I'm glad you touched on that story in the Tribune today, because actually it kind of echoes on things I've been saying for quite some time about, you know, parents and students, you know, at that critical time when you're looking about where are you going to go after graduating high school to continue your education, and the real trepidation about attending an Illinois public institution of higher education.
It's outrageous. I mean, people are looking at this situation, parents and students, and saying maybe we should consider out-of-state options. They don't know if the funding is going to be there. And it's an immediate issue at Chicago State, which is a great university, that they're actually asking people early this week. They're asking the faculty to give back their keys. They changed that at the end of the week, but it's a mess. And Eastern Illinois University, Western Illinois University are great schools, but they're laying off people. They're potentially having to gut major programs. And just think about it. For some reason, 91% of the budget is on autopilot. That means there's been no appropriations for it. There has been absolutely no vote by the legislature for that, except for the K-12 budget, which the governor ended up signing. And we're not funding higher education. Zero. We're not funding a dollar. But I am optimistic about one thing, Rick. That's why I think this might be a little bit different interview that we've had in the past. Is about a week and a half ago, the Supreme Court ruled on the Chicago pension bill, but they also ruled on the AFSCME, the state worker back pay. And they very specifically said in that ruling that in order for money to actually be spent, it needs to be appropriated. And I believe that might set a way to end this crisis. There could be, I think, an attempt by some simply to take that court ruling and say, how are we spending 91% of the budget? Some of it will be covered by consent decrees, but how are we paying state worker workers? How are we doing other things without a budget? And in my view is we need a permanent budget. That might be a way for this crisis to finally come to an end.
We're speaking with State Representative David McSweeney, a Republican state representative from Barrington Hills. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. On the phone, Representative David McSweeney, Republican from Barrington Hills. Representative, before we went to break, you were talking about how that Supreme Court ruling that basically that state worker salaries have to be appropriated by the legislature as a potential turning point here. Do you envision some kind of action to go in and basically have a court now issue a declaratory judgment that we can't pay state worker salaries as something to move things forward here?
I think it's likely, Rick, that somebody's going to take that action. And it's not just state worker salaries. It's other expenditures. You know, I mean, again, I keep saying 91% of the budget is on autopilot. We're increasing the deficit every day. We're going to run a $5 billion deficit. And the legislature has not authorized most of that spending. So I do believe there will be action. I think that's our best hope, frankly, of finally ending this crisis and coming up with a budget. We're now the last in the country. Pennsylvania, actually, you reached a budget deal 2 weeks ago, and we're destroying the state, as we just talked about, especially with higher ed.
But Kentucky, apparently, they're having problems resolving their two-year budget. So we might not be, you know, we might not be first again when it comes to these kinds of things. But we've talked all along in these 10 months about various pressure points and those kinds of things. And I was wondering, you know, even setting aside that Supreme Court ruling, if you believe maybe just the fact of what we're seeing on the higher education front, as we were talking about earlier, if that is a significant enough pressure point on its own to get some action going.
Well, I would hope so. When we're talking about literally trashing and destroying our universities, I would hope that people would finally act. I mean, there's this comedy, which is really not a comedy, but a sad commentary going back and forth about whether the governor and the speaker and others will set up a meeting. To the best of my knowledge, they haven't met since December, which is absolutely outrageous. The leaders should be meeting around the clock I mean, literally 20 hours a day trying to resolve this crisis, and the rank and file members should be doing the same. So I would hope that the destruction of the higher education system in this state, basic social services are being gutted, as we saw with Lutheran Social Services. Catholic Charities is in danger of going under. I would hope that would spur people to action.
Well, and when we talk about higher ed, too, and not just what the potential devastation is for these units of higher education, these universities and colleges, but also they're frankly kind of economic lifelines in a lot of these communities in downstate Illinois.
They absolutely are. In fact, they're very important to small businesses, the entire community, and some of the downstate communities are already hurting, losing manufacturing jobs. The last thing we should be doing is talking about shutting down universities because we aren't doing our job.
We've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning, Rick. Couple of points. You mentioned a massive tax hike. I mean, nobody is in favor of that. But I think you would have to agree that in order to get out of this deficit, there's going to have to be some revenue generated. I want you to comment on that. And secondly, there is a perception that most your Republican colleagues will not agree with any tax revenues until the Democrats agree to some of these positions that the governor wants to take. So comment on that. Is that your position? And what do you feel about tax revenues? Thank you.
Ron, thank you very much for the question. I don't think we need a tax increase in the state, and let me be very specific why. First, we need to adopt real pension reform. President Cullerton has a path toward pension reform. I support that bill. And also, the Supreme Court has said that we can restructure or reamortize the pension debt. We're putting $7 billion a year in a broken system. My view is that we should restructure that pension debt. We can save $2 to $2.5 billion a year. And we need real Medicaid reform. We need to protect the truly needy, but we need to reduce rates that are provided to providers. We also need to move people into HMOs at a much more rapid rate. And we also need to make sure we're getting more federal money. We're only getting 50 cents to the dollar here in Illinois. Some states are getting 70 cents. And through Medicaid waivers, we can get more money from the federal government. We could reduce administrative expenses. So it would be tough, and I am in favor of making those reforms. That's a much better option than raising taxes. We tried raising taxes. That didn't work. My view is we could reform the pensions and the Medicaid systems in this state, and we can actually save a lot of money, and we can avoid a tax increase. But we need to do it now. The deficit's increasing every day.
Representative McSweeney, I want to go back to that issue of the pension ruling by the Supreme Court, as well as Senate President John Cullerton's proposal. And I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but it basically, and I know you're not a lawyer, but it falls under this issue of what's known as consideration, and that you can change, you can basically change the deal in consideration for an alternative benefit. And I'm not so sure that what the Senate president is talking about, and you know, he is a lawyer, but I'm not so sure what he's talking about meets that kind of constitutional test for consideration. Because, I mean, quite frankly, some have suggested that changing benefits or how the pension is calculated, those kinds of things, that pensioners or state employees should have the option not to make any change at all as part of consideration.
Well, two important parts of the Chicago pension decision. Number one, they actually specifically referred to consideration. And I think the standard is if it's a reasonable choice. And in the president's bill, what the choice is given to employees is that they can have future salary increases that would count toward calculating their future pension benefits, but they'd have to trade that off for a lower cost of living. I think that's a reasonable choice. The second part of which I thought was really interesting is they specifically said that as part of collective bargaining, that consideration would even be a more powerful tool. So I was pleased that in that ruling that I believe, and in the experts that I've spoken to, that they give a roadmap for consideration. So while anything will be challenging, I think we need to move forward, and I think the President Cullerton's proposals offers the best path right now. But you also need, I believe, in order to address Ron's question before, you need to restructure or reamortize the pension debt, and the Supreme Court in their decision 2015 specifically said that that's allowable.
With the notation by the court as far as collective bargaining being a strong unifying factor for implementing any of these changes, doesn't that necessarily, though, perhaps run counter to some of the kind of the items that Governor Rauner has proposed in his turnaround agenda, where he basically wants items removed from collective bargaining?
Well, specifically on the issue of salaries, if we're going to use President Cullerton's proposal as the base, which I think we should, it seems like it's a more powerful argument if that remains within collective bargaining for purposes of calculating the pensions. Now, you know, there's specific language that's going back and forth between all the different parties right now, but I do think there was a strong signal from the court that consideration is something that they would certainly entertain, and that as long as the pension and salary discussions are part of collective bargaining, that it seems like it would be a stronger case for pension reform. And we have to get pension reform done here in this state.
So how does that affect the turnaround agenda?
Well, I mean, there's many parts of the turnaround agenda, as you know. I mean, there's workers' compensation.
Specifically more the union weakening provisions.
Well, what the governor's most recent proposal is to allow local governments to make those decisions. So I don't think anything would change. Local governments would still have the ability to decide what they want to or don't want to include in collective bargaining. They would have that choice, and they could also then decide whether they want to include that in as they factor in the effect on pension reform. So that's the latest proposal the governor has. There are a variety of different items that, from work rules, other items that would be covered. So I don't think it would have a major impact on the governor's proposal because it would still give local governments the option of deciding to do it or not.
State Representative David McSweeney, Republican from Barrington Hills, will be keeping an eye on you as well as the rest of the General Assembly as you return to session next week. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Right. Thanks. And we need a budget in this state, Rick.
And we need a Blackhawks win, too.
Absolutely. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you. We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin, the second hour of the Sunday Spin, our review of politics and what's going on in policy in the state and the city. And joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio, I'm very pleased to have Teresa Ma. And Teresa's the Democratic nominee in the 2nd House District from the city of Chicago, and that includes Chinatown, Bridgeport, Pilsen, McKinley Park, back of the yards. And Teresa's primary victory was probably one of the more newsworthy events that happened, even though everybody looks at the presidential on the top of the ticket. But won a very, very close race. This was the seat vacancy being left by State Representative Eddie Acevedo, and his son Alex Acevedo was running to succeed him, and that's who you ended up defeating in a very close contest.
Good morning, Rick. It's great to be here. Yeah, that's right. Close contest, 515 votes.
So how did you win?
Well, I worked really hard. I'd been knocking on doors since the summer. I talked to voters, listened to them, and really was able to get my message across. I also put together a coalition of volunteers and donors and voters. I had a multilingual, multi-ethnic campaign. We had campaign literature in three different languages. Really reached out to all the voters in the district. And
well, I think that multi-ethnic, multi-racial component was a key part of this, given this is a very diverse district. And here you will become, because we know how Democratic Party politics works, Democratic primary politics works in Chicago, that in January you will become the first Asian American member of the Illinois General Assembly.
Absolutely. I'm proud of that. It's exciting for me to represent the Asian American community, but all the constituents in my district, it's, as you said, a very diverse district, and I love it. I love how wonderful and diverse it is, and I got to meet a lot of the folks while I was knocking on doors and going to various churches and block parties, CAPS meetings, community events, and so I was in every corner of the district, got to talk to everyone, and it was a fantastic experience.
One of the things that I thought was unique, and I don't mean to generalize here, but typically, and you know, I'm down in the South Loop, not far away from Chinatown, and it seems typically politically, the Chinatown community is kind of just goes with what they are used to, and that in this case, you rocked the boat. How did the vote? How did that happen?
Well, they've never had someone that they could really identify with and relate to and fully come out to support in an election. It wasn't until 2011 that we redrew the boundaries of that district to include the vast majority of the Chinatown population in that area. So,
and that's always had been an issue of how fractured, as far as political boundaries were, how fractured the Chinatown community was.
Right. So we worked really hard to get the population all in a single district so that folks would have a voice and have the ability to vote someone in or out. And so this year I emerged as the candidate who was able to excite them and get their vote. And I'm excited to represent them in Springfield.
So obviously, you're no stranger to Springfield and the politics that's been going on. And, you know, here we are 10 months without a state budget. We just had Republican Representative David McSweeney on talking about his concerns. What do you bring to the table as far as a perspective that of looking at this from the outside? And we may not have a budget when you get sworn in January.
That's outrageous, and it's been hurting a lot of people. I've heard the stories while I've been knocking on doors. What I would like to do in Springfield is bring those voices to the table so that there's more attention focused on...
I mean, people always use that stakeholders thing, but these are... You're talking about the real people.
The real people and the real stories that are out there. I mean, folks who are losing jobs, losing services. There's a lot of suffering. I mean, the students who have come to me and talked about how devastating it is that they're losing their MAP grants, you know, social services that have to shut down. We're really facing a situation where the social service infrastructure in our state is at risk. It's crumbling in front of our eyes. And this is just an outrageous situation that needs to change. And so I bring an independent voice to Springfield. I also have a deep desire to be a voice for the people in my district and make sure that their experiences are heard, you know, when these negotiations are going on.
One of the concerns that I've talked about on this show several times, particularly about social services and the crumbling of that safety net network, is that this doesn't seem to be, because of the special people that participate and believe in wanting to help, and those are unique individuals, but that should the cash flow spigot get turned on from a budget agreement, those social services and the people who work for them and are being laid off, they don't just automatically come back and spring back into life.
That's right. It's taken many, many years to build up what we have. And so, you know, to put our state in a situation where this system, our social services infrastructure, gets damaged and destroyed in this way is really outrageous, because it does take a while for things to get built back up. And, you know, in the meantime, it's hurting our economy.
And not to mention all of the at-risk individuals or those who need those services that have no place to turn to.
In many cases, it's a life and death situation. People are really suffering, and I feel for them. I feel an obligation to try to get something done.
We're speaking with Teresa Ma. She's the Democratic nominee in the 2nd House District from the city of Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Teresa Ma. She's the Democratic nominee in the 2nd House District in the city of Chicago. And we're talking about perspectives that she can bring when she is inaugurated with the new General Assembly in January. We all know kind of where the struggle is in this budget mess between Governor Rauner and what he calls his turnaround agenda, and then Democrats who control supermajorities in the House and Senate. And we have no movement. And certainly what parts of the governor's agenda, particularly the union weakening provisions, are things that the Democrats are just not going to support. And I've said throughout this that, and even looking at some of the post-primary responses from the governor, from the speaker, when you have both sides that think they're winning, you're never going to move anything. I'd be interested in your take on that kind of struggle. As you say, you bring an independent voice to this.
And I also bring a voice that represents the people in my district. And, you know, one of the things that I stand pretty firmly on is the need to preserve the institutions that help build the middle class. And so, you know, I'm on the side of making sure that our unions don't get destroyed. And, you know, I was out there marching with the teachers the other day. I serve on the local school council of a neighborhood high school. And so, you know, I'm there to focus on investing in our education system and making sure that the families in our district get a fair shake.
Well, let's talk about education funding, because that's obviously been something in the news, even aside from the issue of Friday's day of action and those kinds of things, is the fact that you do have the governor say, I think there ought to be more money in Illinois' public education system. And we have always, every politician says, education's my number one priority. But then you start breaking that down, and you have Senate President John Cullerton saying that we need to redo the school aid formula, that how when schools got, I think it was $275 million more in elementary secondary funding, the only part of the budget that really got funded, but yet Chicago still took a hit under the formula, and now we, you know, have some of these dire warnings about the fate of the Chicago public schools. Where do you fall into all of this kind of thing?
Well, I don't know if you know, but my background's in education. I spent 15 years teaching at the college level. So I think it's important to invest in our educational system, make sure that higher education is accessible to the families in the district and all over Illinois. I am a firm believer in the need to make sure that all those resources are accessible, especially for the immigrant families in my district. You know, I'm from an immigrant family, and for me, in order to get where I am today, I had to have access to good quality education, and I want that for all the families in our district.
Well, just to interject, we have Governor Rauner saying that, you know, maybe not necessarily every student high school graduate needs to go to a university, that maybe more vocational training, those kinds of things. And of course, for decades, even covering presidential candidates, we'd go to community colleges that were having partnerships with companies and for that kind of vocational stuff, but it never seems to have become a unified or unified forceful effort from the federal government or the state government. Mm-hmm. But, you know, tied with that is the fact that, you know, everybody, I think, believes that every student should have the opportunity to go to college if they want to.
Absolutely. And we need to make sure that K through 12 and early childhood is available to make sure that students can go to college if they want to, and that we invest in a system that prepares our students for whatever future that they see for themselves. I mean, if it's apprenticeships and alternatives to four-year college, that's fine. But we need to strengthen our education system all the way around, and we need to make sure that students have access.
But that takes money.
It does.
And where does the money come from?
It does. Well, you know, when I was campaigning, I talked a lot about the need to close corporate tax loopholes. And what I bring to the table is, you know, I'm an independent voice in the state legislature now. You know, I ran a campaign where I raised money from individual donors, over 800 individual donors. And, you know, I didn't have, special interest groups or PACs giving me money. I'm able to go to Springfield and fight for some of these revenue ideas that, you know, folks who are part of the status quo aren't willing to speak up about.
Does that include, for example, on the issue of pensions, one of the things that Forrest Claypool has talked about, Mayor Rahm Emanuel has talked about, the issue of, as far as the pensions of Chicago, teachers are paid through local property taxes, where for every district outside the city, that's a state-funded component, and that's it's been one of those issues that has helped create the pension mess, that the 3% compounded cost of living, those kinds of things. Can you talk about pensions and that idea about maybe the local districts outside Chicago should be picking up the cost of pensions rather than that being necessarily a state obligation?
Well, however we end up doing it, I think the bottom line is that we need to make sure our teachers are well compensated and that we're not constantly, you know, trying to take away, you know, what they need to do well in the classrooms and really serve our kids. So funding our education system means that, you know, we make sure that the conditions in the classroom are good for the kids, that we don't have class sizes that are too large, and that we don't keep taking resources away from teachers, you know, because they work really hard. And, you know, as somebody who's an educator myself, you know, I know what they go through. And I hear a lot of the criticisms that are directed at teachers, you know.
Well, like, I was just going to mention, because, I mean, certainly for every supporter of a teacher, there's the, well, you know, they make too much money, they don't have to work in the summer, those kinds of things. That, I mean, how do you respond to those kinds of criticisms?
Well, the teachers I know, they work after hours. Their work doesn't stop in the summers. And now, you know, with the attempt to take this away and take that away, you know, a lot of them are having to do multiple jobs, it seems, you know. So they're not just, you know, teaching the classes that they're assigned to, but they're having to pick up other responsibilities because things are being cut left and right. You know, there's staffing issues at a lot of schools. And, you know, I think that they work a lot harder than they're given credit for. Especially from these critics.
Easy targets?
I think so. I mean, when I was teaching, you know, I heard those criticisms. Oh, you know, you only work 9 months out of the year. But actually, the work doesn't stop. And, you know, if you want to be a good teacher, I mean, you're available and around, and you're there mentoring the kids, and you're writing letters of recommendation. You're doing all kinds of things that are not part of the everyday job description.
And we probably should mention, too, when it comes to pensions, teachers they're not part of the Social Security system. So
right.
that is their
right.
benefit.
And, you know, what they were promised is what they should get.
That's Teresa Ma. She is the Democratic nominee in the 2nd House District in the city of Chicago, and will be taking that seat come January of 2017. And hopefully there'll be a state budget by then.
Hopefully.
Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It was a pleasure.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Kind of, we talked a little bit about how Tuesday is the presidential primary vote in Wisconsin, and kind of an interesting factor going on up there as initially Donald Trump about a month, 6 weeks ago, was way up in the polls there, but now the latest polling shows Texas Senator Ted Cruz in first, Trump in second, and Kasich lagging in third. And kind of this development where Cruz's, the super PAC that supports Ted Cruz, they're going after Ohio Governor John Kasich. They're not going after Donald Trump. I want to play a portion. This is the Cruz super PAC ad.
The John Kasich playbook. Holding for a last-second shot and blocking out the grassroots. But that's classic John Kasich. Millionaires working side-by-side with George Soros are bankrolling his super PAC, while Kasich votes against the Second Amendment and expanded Obamacare in Ohio, costing taxpayers billions. So given John Kasich's liberal record, it's no surprise his campaign isn't rebounding, because John Kasich won't play in Wisconsin. Trusted Leadership PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
So that's the Ted Cruz super PAC, and of course, the Kasich super PAC then decides to go after Cruz with an ad using Donald Trump's nickname for Cruz, and in this ad, it shows Cruz with his nose growing for the lies he tells, and the nose growing and growing until it wraps around his neck several times. But here's the audio from that ad.
Many just call him Lion Ted. Lied about Ben Carson to steal a win in Iowa. Lies about being the best for the GOP when polls show he can't even beat Hillary Clinton. His TV ad about John Kasich? Lie. Stations had to pull it off the air. If Ted Cruz's mouth is moving, he's lying.
New Day Independent Media Committee, Inc. is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Yeah, there's that civility factor that I was talking about earlier. Well, joining me now in the Allstate Showcase studio is my good friend and Tribune colleague, Juan Pelaez Jr., education reporter. And Juan was out there all day Friday as the Chicago Teachers Union had their big day of action. And, of course, this was kind of supplemented by various other protest groups, the Fight for $15 an Hour Wage, Service Employees International Union. Yeah. I mean, it was a full day of protests. But I guess the bottom line is, and this is reflective of your story, is what will it lead to?
Yeah, that's that's the 100 million or 250 million.
I was just going. Yeah, what is
480 million?
$480 million question.
$1 billion question. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm trying to think about what's going to happen Monday, and then what's going to happen Tuesday, what's going to happen in the weeks following. And I think that's a question that's confronting the union right now is, you know, like we talked about this morning in that story with Kim Geiger, how do they leverage this action and actually turn it into something? And by something, legislation, and by legislation that's going to get passed very quickly.
Well, tangible and tangible with cash.
Right. Immediate cash. If the dire projections are to be believed, and the numbers are very grim, so whatever legislative maneuver is going to happen is going to have to take effect with some degree of frequency, right? I mean, if it's as bad as it looks, we don't necessarily have a lot of time for another protracted legislative battle, right? So,
but as much as we've talked about this, and yeah, we kind of keep waiting for the last shoe to drop.
Yep.
Because it's like a moving target, though.
Yeah.
But we keep waiting for that last shoe to drop. But that having been said, we have talked about the fact, if you're relying on Springfield for help these days, you're not in a very good position to leverage much of anything.
So that's, I think, how are you going to get legislators on your side and a sufficient number of them to override any kind of potential veto action, right? And what kind of legislation are you going to come up with? Because, you know, both sides, and by both sides, I mean the teachers union and Chicago Public Schools, are on the same page that some kind of legislative intervention is necessary. I think they would, you know, they would agree on that. The question is, how are they both going to get behind something that's going to be palatable enough to everybody to actually advance? And if you hear about some of the ideas that the union wants to get passed, I don't know that it's something that is going to gain a lot of traction with a lot of people.
Right.
With a lot of people. So, you know, is there compromise somehow in there in this day of not many compromises that they can get, you know, that they can find some kind of measure that can not only gain support from both aisles, but enough to actually, like, you know, move the needle and pass both houses.
And of course, you know, we know Governor Rauner has long had a dislike for the Chicago Teachers Union.
Big target on Friday.
But here he has said, and as I was speaking with Teresa Ma, he supports more money for schools. Senate President John Cullerton supports more money for schools, but wants a change in the school aid formula. Rauner is saying that's a complicated thing. He believes the school aid formula is unfair, but to make the changes in it would take too much time to address in a current round of funding. But he still maintains that funding is conditional upon parts of his turnaround agenda that include union weakening rules about negotiations. So I don't know that the needle has moved anywhere in this.
And so, and I guess this is something I wanted to ask you. I was thinking about this on the way over this morning. How much time really would everybody have to actually get together? I mean, how long would it take to actually pass a serious piece of legislation in that short of a time frame when this session comes back in? I mean, how much?
Well, if you had an agreement.
If you had everybody on board, you could do it pretty quick, right?
Yes.
Now, if you're dropping some kind of bomb that's going to take both sides to reach some kind of compromise on, I mean, have you ever seen anything happen like that in a very short time frame before, where something like...
Not of this complication,
right? I mean, the school funding formula, that thing is...
Well, truly, I mean, and you are probably more familiar with the intricacies of the school aid formula than you wish you were. And
I don't know.
But ask any rank-and-file legislator in Springfield how the school aid fund formula works, and they can't explain it either.
It's difficult.
And whenever you deal with that issue of school funding, you're always tasked. I hate that word tasked, but that's really what it is. You're tasked with trying to find a way so that you don't just reshake it up so there are different winners and losers. Mm. Because, and this comes to the heart of it, I think where there is agreement is, yeah, there probably ought to be more money in the formula, and that there are no losers, that the districts that might lose money are held harmless. They wouldn't lose. But that having been said, you're talking about a great deal of money here, and you're talking about where you're going to get it, what resources can you bring to bear. And that's just the education component when you're looking at a state without a budget that is falling further and further behind to the tune of billions of dollars in paying bills for everything else.
So, doesn't sound like prospects are very realistic. I mean, but that's right.
I mean,
that's a very difficult mountain to cross, surmount, climb, to, you know, fall back off of if you're not careful. So really, you know, what happens Monday and what happens through the rest of the week as far as moving the needle? I don't know that the needle moves much, but, you know, I think the union would cast this action as a step in its work to build this populist revival.
I mean, certainly, you know, if you just look at the aesthetics of the protest. I mean, the visuals were very strong.
Yes.
We have, you know, in our polling that we've done, those polls have repeatedly showed in Chicago that voters side overwhelmingly with the teachers union as opposed to Mayor Emanuel. You also have the fact that, you know, Bruce Rauner was trying to use Emanuel and the schools to help leverage, you know, the mega deal. And now that, I mean, that never worked.
I don't know where.
and you also have a vastly weakened, politically weakened mayor at the same time.
So that, somebody smells blood of some sort in the water somewhere. And I mean, there's an opportunity here. I think the union would see this as an opportunity to advance its own interests. And
but when we talk about against those of CPS and Emanuel, or the governor, or whoever it is
that they're targeting, I think they feel like, you know, that there's something. Let me put it this way: one organizer talked to me a couple days ago on Friday, and was, in his perspective, saying that, in his view, this more progressive, left-leaning movement that's is emerging right now, or to whatever extent that is something that has eroded control of what he calls downtown Democrats, quote unquote. Those are his words, downtown Democrats. And so I think there are people in the union, though, when we talk about compromise, who look at something like this and sense an advantage, but might think that, well, there's no reason to necessarily let off the gas pedal right now. You know, some of these guys are on the ropes, we think, right? So let's continue going after them because, you know, there's something to be won here.
There's a bigger victory to be had.
I think that's a good way of putting it.
We're speaking with Juan Perez Jr., my colleague at the Tribune on the education beat, which kind of blends over to the political the political team coverage. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined here in the Allstate Showcase Studio by my colleague from the Tribune, Juan Perez Jr., our education reporter. We're talking about the activities on Friday and what may lie ahead as far as Chicago Public Schools, Chicago Teachers Union, education funding, and how that all wraps up into the overall lack of a state budget as we go for 10 months. And I was speaking to him off the air, and I said, you know, these are, I have been doing this a long time. And yeah,
I'm like, yes.
Hey, kids, get off my lawn. I've never seen really times like this before, and where everything is so wrapped up into each other and none of it moves. There's no movement on as far as anything, trying to find resolution. And what scares me is back in the day when I first started covering Illinois government and politics many years ago, but I was working for United Press International. I wasn't working for the Tribune. So basically, I could say that the legislature was stalled on Chicago-related issues, period and paragraph. Now you got to know what those issues are. And the issues are so complex and hard to digest sometimes. And then you come into this factor of divided government in a way like I've never seen it before in Springfield. And I always would joke that, you know, that's how Washington acts. That's not how they do it in Springfield. There's a real understanding that you have to step up to the plate, do the statesman-like thing to keep things running. And now it's become such a winner-take-all political game for Republicans and Democrats in Springfield that you become very hard-pressed to see a way out of the morass.
And this is another thing I wanted to ask you about. Is like I don't understand how compromise emerges from this sometimes. You know, when you look at it and you put everything out on a table and you just, you know, look at printouts of competing position statements or notes or ideas or just all, you know, this morass that you talk about, right? Like what, with so many wild cards at play, like it doesn't seem like there's one real key to advancing everything and fixing everything, you know? So how sustainable is this? How long can this go? I don't.
Well, and again, this goes back to what we were saying earlier, too, about the real financial straits of the Chicago Public Schools have basically been a moving target. And you and I both have gone through this where there's a certain X date is kind of like a drop date.
This is it. This is it. This is it. This is it. This is really it. This is it.
And it keeps moving, and that does not help, you know, because that's kind of, you know, the Chicken Little, and that's the way lawmakers will act. And frankly, then that's the way the public will act too. It's like, how many times have I been told that X date is going to be the final date for something to happen, and it just escapes.
I should look this up in the clips. I should look up the words crying wolf and just like see like how many times that comes up in the archives. I bet it does more often than once, right?
Yeah, but you know it, from experience that when it comes to politicians acting, they'd rather not.
That would certainly, I guess that would present itself as the easier option. But then again, if it's as bad as it's said to be, and it looks pretty bad, you know, at some point that becomes a vulnerability, doesn't it? I mean,
and now we have this. I was going to ask you too about the ruling about from Lisa Madigan, the Attorney General's opinion, that says that Chicago Public Schools still have the power to borrow, despite the efforts by Governor Rauner and the State Board of Education to try to constrain that ability.
Yeah, so that was an interesting development. I think the statute that was getting thrown about when this whole so really, I mean, just to kind of catch people up here, and this is a very cliff-noted version, but the State Board of Education and obviously, you know, the governor's administration launched an investigation, a financial investigation into Chicago Public Schools, which at the outset just basically entailed the state asking the district for a lot of paperwork, and then the district kind of replying with, you know, well, a lot of this is already on the internet. I mean, here it is, but, you know, it's already out there kind of thing. That was funny. But the upshot was whether or not the school district would be determined to be in quote-unquote financial difficulty, right?
which people saw as a first step by the governor.
Correct.
Who has suggested and would like to see legislation passed that would allow CPS to go bankrupt.
And this particular statute that they were relying on for a determination of financial difficulty, I think one of the potential consequences for a district that runs awry of this law would be that, it can't borrow any more money. We need to, you know, and we're running on a credit card and a payday loan and, we've got, my watch and hawk and all sorts of stuff to kind of keep the school district running right now. But the law was, I think the district would argue the law was very clear that Chicago Public Schools was exempted from any kind of those punitive measures. And, the ruling out Friday, you know, very wonderful timing, of course.
Yes, indeed.
I love this state. was certainly, I think, just kind of reiterated the status quo for a lot of people. But the governor has suggested some support for legislation that would allow the school system to go bankrupt. Bankruptcy gets talked about a lot, but bankruptcy takes a very long time, just legally speaking, to happen. Like, you know, working through a Chapter 9 proceeding for something like this. We talk about a morass. I mean, I can't even imagine, or I guess I can, you know, imagine like just the stacks and stacks and stacks of legal filings and just the amount of money that would be burned on something like that. Ultimately, you could even have a judge telling you, well, you know, raise taxes, you know, because you still have the, you know, there is still room to do that before everything goes, you know, really, really explodes. Right. So, you know, is bankruptcy and I get asked a lot if bankruptcy is an option. And I guess right now the answer is no, because it's not legal yet. But even if it was, it doesn't quite work the way I think people think it would work.
That it would immediately wipe away all of the past debts and those kinds of things. No, that all becomes negotiations and creditors.
Right. And vendors.
Yes.
You know, people are going to want to get paid. And so, you know, just working through, you know, in the bond market and just trying to determine like how this is all going to get divvied up, if it ever even happened, would take years, I would assume.
Juan Perez Jr., my Tribune colleague, education writer for the Chicago Tribune. I think we're both like Debbie Downers today or something like that. Yeah, wah, wah, wah. No, but thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank
I appreciate
you for having
it.
Me. That was fun.
We'll be back with more right after this. Very quickly, I want to remind everybody that the Road to Literacy Conference is coming up. That's my friends at the Literacy Volunteers of Illinois. And you can go to lvillinois.org to get more information about that. I also want to thank my guests this morning, David McSweeney, Republican State Representative from Barrington Hills, Teresa Ma, who's the Democratic nominee in the 2nd House District of Chicago, and my good buddy Juan Perez Jr. And also want to thank all of you for listening. And now it's time to turn things over on this happy Shamrock Sunday.
Don't even try to start trouble. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm trying to be more positive.
When it comes to jogging and races and street closures,
right.
I don't think of you as Mr. Positive.
I just report what's going on. I don't give opinions about what's happening out there. I just talk about how it's.
Oh, good. You're playing the journalist card here.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
That's all
sure.
I do. I'm just a guy trying to get to work. That's all it is, really. And I will say, I didn't run into any barricades, any mouse mazes that they usually put up this year.
So you do have reason to be optimistic.
I could not be happier today.
Wow, that's so refreshing. I wasn't sure what I was going to get when I tossed this to you.
And if anybody believes that, we have a short show. Maybe that's why I'm so happy.
There
we have
go.
A short show
yes.
today. That's
Black
what
Hawks.
It is. Blackhawks pregame coming up at 11. So we have a 4-hour show packed into 2 hours today.